Well, good morning. Hurricanes. That's some rough stuff there. We got a scripture reading from the band on from the book of Job. And if you think about that, here's a guy living his life, dedicated to God, most righteous man on the planet, and then disaster sets in. Every possible awful thing that could happen just out of nowhere falls on him. And of course, we have these, we have the hurricanes, and you get the first one and you think, wow, you know, as bad as it was, at least it's over. Wrong. Wrong. Another one comes up right behind it. I live in New York, and I'm glad, because I would be one of the people who doesn't evacuate. And I'm so incredibly stupid when it comes to things like that, that it would be mostly based on the name. I would be like, I can't run from something called Irma. I think they should give them like more intimidating names, like, you know, Hurricane Dementor or something like that. Something that I would want to run from. My wife just escaped the Hurricane Harvey in Houston. For those of you who have been, I know lots of you follow Nabil's posts, Nabil Qureshi, former Muslim. Nabil was diagnosed with stage 4 stomach cancer, I think in August of just last year. And so that's something that just came out of nowhere. And the 5-year survival rate is around 4% for if you're diagnosed with stage 4 stomach cancer. And so, just up to 4 or 5 months ago, Nabil was still looking completely healthy. And then as the cancer started going into other systems, started breaking down, and the doctors are not too happy with the way things are going right now. They just stopped his tube feeding. And right before Hurricane Harvey, my wife went down to visit Nabil. I had gone down a little earlier, but she went down, and the morning she left early in the morning to go get on a plane. And we have 4 sons. 2 of them have a genetic muscle disease, so their muscles don't work. They're maybe 5% as strong as regular muscles, but they can't breathe on their own. They need machines to breathe. We feed them with machines and so on. And my wife leaves in the morning, and we have a nurse that comes at night so that we can sleep. And the nurse tells me in the morning that she thinks my youngest has a broken leg. And he certainly didn't have a broken leg the night before. And so I thought, well, she's obviously insane. There's no way he just got a broken leg out of nowhere. He was in bed all night. The only time he would have been moved around is her lifting him up for a bath or something like that. So didn't pay much attention. He wasn't crying. He was fine. And eventually I just wanted to make sure nothing was wrong. And so I touched his leg, and he started crying when I touched his leg. And I'm still thinking, there's no way this is a broken femur. I mean, I've had broken bones, and you certainly are not sitting there calmly if you've just had a broken bone. But eventually I decided to call the paramedics and so on, because his leg was in pain. I was worried about some sort of infection or blood clot. I don't know a lot about these things. I know his leg was in a lot of pain. And when the paramedics lifted him up, it looked like his leg was made of rubber. It just flopped right in the middle. And so he did have a broken femur. We took him to the hospital, and they x-rayed it, and we had no idea, but because his muscles are weak and he doesn't stand on his legs, his femur bones, even though he's 7 years old, his femur is thinner than my pinky. And so just by lifting him up into a bath or something like this now, his bones can break. And so I contact my wife. Of course, Paley has a broken femur. She's down in Houston trying to see Nabil and finding out her son has a broken leg. And so she visits Nabil, and then has them schedule her for an earlier flight to leave, and she got out on one of the last flights because there was a mad scramble to get out of Houston once that hurricane, once the hurricane started coming. And so now we know that our son Paley has what look like bird bones because he doesn't put much weight on them to do things, and so. But I mean, just all these things happening at once, right? I mean, my wife wants to go see Nabil because she might not get another chance, and just going down there, and then immediately has to rush back, and almost gets blasted with the hurricane, and then. Nabil does get blasted with the hurricane, and they have to evacuate him from his house because it's in a flood zone and take him to the hospital. And he's already had his stomach removed. He'd been in the hospital for weeks. They finally take him home, and as soon as he gets home, oh, by the way, the hurricane is going to hit here. We have to get out of here. And all of this just before the service, I was talking to my friend John Mark out in the hall. He's doing the youth service, and I hadn't seen John Mark in, I guess, about 2 years, and the things that have happened to him since then are so horrifyingly terrifying to me, because if they can happen to him, they can happen to any of us. And the things that have happened terrify me, because I mean, this guy's been attacked in all of the worst ways possible over the past couple of years. And but at the end of all that, the end of that, when he was sharing how things had gone, I said, you know, that really sounds like massive spiritual attack. Really sounds like you are under massive spiritual attack. And if you are under massive spiritual attack, maybe it's because there are spirits who regard what you're doing as a massive threat. And so the positive side of that sort of thing is whatever you were on the path to doing, make sure you keep doing that, because that is going to be some powerful stuff. And so that's, you know, and with him, it's just like obvious spiritual attack. He's not getting, you know, a physical disease or, you know, weak muscles or something like this. It's just everything going very badly in his life. So that sort of thing, just look at it and say spiritual attack. But you have different situations where it's like Nabil. You just get a disease out of nowhere. And I know lots of you are familiar with the Nabil's background and so on. I know some of you aren't, so I'll go ahead and share it very briefly. But Nabil was raised as a Muslim. We became best friends in college, and it was about 4 years of us having discussions, going to debates, reading books. We would write out our arguments for why we believe Christianity is true or false, why we believe Islam is true or false. And we spent years doing this. And during that time, there were Christians who were telling me, important Christians who were telling me, stop wasting your time. This guy's obviously hard-hearted here. Sometimes we have like a Billy Graham mentality of evangelism. You preach the gospel and then people convert, and if they don't, they're just not receptive to the gospel, and so you move on. But that approach does, the Billy Graham approach does work for certain kinds of people. The people that would normally show up to a Billy Graham crusade are people who, at the end of the day, believe in the Bible, they believe in God, they believe in Jesus, they've just never made a commitment to him. And so you preach the gospel message clearly, make sure they understand it, and they say, no, what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for? Why are you not committed to Jesus Christ? And people would come forward. If you're dealing with Muslims, it's not that simple. It's not like that. They have tons of objections to Christianity that they've been taught since birth. They have massive misunderstandings of what Christianity even teaches. When you say Jesus is the Son of God, they assume you're talking about God producing an offspring with Mary. God having sex with Mary and producing Jesus as an offspring. And so everything you say is being misinterpreted. Very difficult to reach with the gospel if a Muslim's hearing some of this for the first time. And so if you're talking to Muslims, very often you have to be in this for the long run. And so there are Christians who have that quick evangelism mentality where, you know, David, you're wasting your time spending years talking to this person when you could be out talking to tons of other people. But after about 4 years, Nabeel became a Christian, and it was amazing watching him and being part of what was going on during that time. He was in his first public debate against a Muslim imam in less than a year after he left Islam and became a Christian. And he did many debates after that. He was in medical school, and simultaneously, because he wanted to study apologetics, he wanted to be able to defend the faith as Christians are commanded, 1 Peter 3:15. He wanted to be able to defend the faith, so he enrolled in the master's program in apologetics at Biola while he's in medical school. So he's doing two graduate programs simultaneously. When he finished those, he went off to Duke University, did a master's in religion, joined Ravi Zacharias International Ministries as a speaker, went to Oxford, got a master's degree in New Testament studies there. Came out with three books. Two of them were New York Times bestsellers, Seeking Allah, Finding Jesus, many people have read, and was working on his doctorate at Oxford University in New Testament studies, arguing for a very early dating of the Gospel of Mark. So lots of people put the, many scholars put the date of the Gospel of Mark around 70 AD. Which puts the first of the Gospels sort of, you know, several decades after the time of Jesus. But the main reason for doing that, the main reason for dating the Gospel of Mark around 70 is that Jesus predicts the fall of Jerusalem in the Gospel of Mark. And so if you don't believe in actual supernatural predictions of Jesus, then you have to say, well, this must have been written after the fall of Jerusalem. Jesus wouldn't have known about it beforehand, and so the gospel must have this early date, must have this late date of 70. And but there's a positive side there, namely that, well, if you do show that there is an early date, and the early date is long before the fall of Jerusalem, well, now you've got someone making miraculous predictions. And so very interesting work, and he had his own argument that he developed on his own for the early dating of the Gospel of Mark. And so sitting back watching Nabeel over just do so much over in so short a time, seeing him put out books, seeing him affect so many lives, seeing him go around the world and speak at universities around the world as part of RZIM, and then in addition to those books, he had multiple book contracts for further books, and then he's working on a PhD at Oxford University. It's like there's no end to his potential there, and yet, in the midst of all that, stomach cancer, and we're not talking stage one, stage four, worst as it can possibly be, right off the bat. And so Nabeel gets that diagnosis, and plans, of course, instantly change. He moves to Houston because they have one of the best cancer treatment centers in the world, and people around the world praying for Nabeel for healing, and he gets better for a while, and then all of a sudden gets much, much worse, to the point where they have to remove his stomach, and the cancer has spread into other organs, and systems are breaking down, and things not looking good at all. Most of the comments that I give, because people, they don't want to bother Nabeel by sending him messages, so they send me the messages and say, could you pass this on to Nabeel? And which I don't know, I would be less of a bother for me to transmit the message than for them to send him a message. But I get tons of messages every day from people saying, you know, pass this on to Nabeel and share this information. And most of the messages that I see regarding Nabeel are prayers for his healing. And that's the vast majority of things we read, prayers for prayers for a miraculous healing before he dies. I saw one interesting message a few days ago. Someone sent me a message and said, my prayer is that if Nabil dies, his parents, who are Muslims, would see a vision of him with Jesus. And I thought, that is a really awesome prayer. Because Nabil wants to live. Nabil wants to be healed. That's what we want. But I also happen to know that Nabil is the kind of person who, if he had to lay down his life so that his parents would know the truth, he would do it. And so, I still hope that Nabil somehow gets a long future with us and gets to do much more work. But if he doesn't, I would love to see his parents come to Christ, and I know he would as well. And so, these are the kinds of things that are going on. But why do we, you know, why are we sitting here hoping for the best, hoping that Nabil is healed, or hoping that it leads to something else, like his parents and his sister and many others being saved? Why, when I hear, you know, my friend Jean-Marc sharing really bad things going on in his life, do I think, well, maybe there is something awesome at work here as well? That's kind of the heart of Christianity. I was, before the time of Nabil, I was in a jail cell when I became a Christian. And going back even before that, there was a guy named Randy who had committed multiple felonies throughout his life, became a Christian. Randy became a Christian, and he became a Christian and went and turned himself in for everything he'd ever done. And he was charged, they looked at the list of everything that he'd done, and they charged him with 21 felonies. They charged him with 21 felonies. He ended up getting 185 years for his 21 felonies. And I end up in jail with this Christian. And I was an atheist at the time. And I made fun of him for being so stupid. And not just stupid for being a Christian. I mean, you're stupid for being a Christian, and you're really stupid for turning yourself in for 21 felonies that no one knew that you did. Randy was the first Christian I had ever met in my entire life who would stand his ground when I would start making fun of him or making fun of Christianity or telling him why he's wrong about Christianity. And that's kind of sad. Every Christian I'd ever started arguing with would always, oh, well, you know, we don't want to cause a scene, we don't want an argument, you know, I'll pray for you, that sort of thing, right? And if you're a sort of aggressive type atheist, you're much more impressed with someone who's going to stand their ground and say, no, you're wrong, and here's why. And that's what Randy did. And he wasn't some brilliant scholar. He wasn't smarter than I was. He just had this annoying habit of asking me why I believed everything I would say I believed. So I would say, well, I believe this. And he'd go, why do you believe that? And it would make me think, wait a minute, why do I believe that? And no one had ever challenged me. And I realized over time that I just picked up certain things throughout my life and never really thought about why I believe these kinds of things. And the answer is, well, I heard it from my 10th grade teacher. And back then, you think teachers know what they're talking about. I've taught philosophy of human nature and philosophical ethics at the university level, and let me tell you, teachers know much less than you think. And that's college level. And I'm always thinking, I barely know anything, you know, let alone my 10th grade teacher. And yet, back then, I'm taking, you know, what my teachers and so on say as they obviously know what they're talking about. I ended up, Randy made me mad enough that I actually started studying Christianity to show him that it's wrong, because other people I would tell them that Christianity is wrong, and they didn't really know why they believed in Christianity, and so they weren't in much of a position to show me that anything I was saying was wrong. Randy had some idea of why he believed what he believed, and so he would start pointing out that my claims were factually false, and I wasn't used to that, so I decided he must be winning these arguments because he just knows more than I do, and so all I need to do is go learn more, and then I'll have the ammunition to refute Randy. So Started reading all kinds of things, but got sets of Bible studies and started working my way through the Gospels and so on. And I eventually became really amazed by the resurrection. And somehow I already understood at that time. I mean, it's in the Bible. I hadn't read what Paul said about the resurrection being so central and everything hinging on the resurrection of Jesus, but I immediately understood it. If this guy rose from the dead, then he's someone special, and if he didn't rise from the dead, then a bunch of stuff got made up. And it was in the course of studying the historical background of early Christian belief that I realized that what I had believed about Christianity was total nonsense. I had believed that Jesus was a preacher. He had some followers. Those followers really liked him and loved him. He died, and they wanted to keep his message going, so they made up a story about him rising from the dead so that they could continue passing on his teachings. And that made perfect sense to me at the time. After dialoguing with Randy and then actually studying instead of just, you know, believing things that popped into my head when I was young, I found out how these guys died, right? Found out these guys went to their horrible bloody deaths proclaiming that Jesus had appeared to them, risen from the dead. And it wasn't just his earthly followers who claimed that they had seen him risen from the dead. It was even people who didn't believe in him during his earthly ministry. His half-brother James did not believe that Jesus was the Messiah. And yet, James eventually claimed to have seen his brother risen from the dead. James was eventually martyred for claiming that Jesus is Lord. The Apostle Paul did not believe in Jesus. He was willing to wipe out Christians. And yet Paul starts proclaiming Christianity and claiming that it's because Jesus had appeared to him, risen from the dead. Why are so many different people all claiming that they'd seen the same man risen from the dead? That is a very strange claim, right? I mean, if one random person says, hey, some guy rose from the dead, you think, oh, okay, got a jacket for you. Like that. But if two or three start saying it, then you start wondering what's going on here. Are they conspiring to tell a lie? What's going on there? If a bunch of people from completely different backgrounds, friends and foes and of all different backgrounds, all start saying it, then you have to say, why are all these people seeing this one guy risen from the dead? And so it became clear to me that they're not lying. That's what I thought. I thought they were lying. I thought they believed they were lying for a good cause, right? They're lying to keep his teachings going. They're lying for a good cause there. I thought that's what they were doing. But as a general rule, liars make poor martyrs. Liars make poor martyrs. If you are lying about something, then when the sword is at your throat, you usually, okay, I was lying. Just don't get that sword away from me. And I was there. I'm there in a jail cell trying to figure out why all of these people were claiming that they had seen the risen Jesus. And I tried to think of one person in all of history who lied, knew he was lying, and then willingly went to his bloody death for the sake of that lie. I couldn't think of one person. There are lots of people who die for a lie, but they have to believe in what they're dying for, right? When a jihadi crashes his plane into a building, I don't know a lot else about the jihadi, but I know he believes what he's dying for. He's not, hey, I'm just lying about belief in Allah, now I'm going to die for him. That doesn't make sense. So lots of people die for what they believe in, but that's the key. They have to believe in it. So the apostles had to believe in what they were dying for. And notice, the apostles are in a completely different position from most other people who die for what they believe. Most people today, there are Christians who die for what they believe, there are Muslims who die for what they believe, lots of people die for what they believe. But people who die for what they believe today die because they believe something that someone else told them, some message they shared, and they believe that it's true, and if they believe it with enough confidence, they'll be willing to die for it, right? A Muslim who crashes his plane into a building was taught Islam. He was taught Islam by his parents or his imam or something like that, but he really believes in Islam. The apostles were not dying for something they heard, some message that was taught to them, something their parents told them. The apostles were dying for something they said they saw. And if they were dying for something that they saw, the question then becomes, what did they see? And I tried to think, what did these people see that could convince the whole group that it was a man risen from the dead? And not just convince them that Jesus had risen from the dead, but convince them with such confidence that even decades later, when they're being tortured, they would not waver. They would not waver, right? I mean, that is a long time. If you saw some ghostly apparition and you thought, oh, Jesus rose and appeared as a ghost or something like that. If you saw something like that decades later when you're being persecuted, you're going to start thinking, did I really see Jesus? Or was that, you know, a coat hanging on a coat rack in the corner or something like that? What was that? What did I see? I can't. To have that kind of confidence, and to the man, every single one, and not, again, not just friends, but foes as well, to have all of them have that same confidence, whatever they saw had a tremendous impact on them. And that is not something that, you know, a coat waving on a coat rack in the corner convinces you of. They had to see something. What did they see? And I couldn't come up with any other explanation than they saw a guy risen from the dead. And if they had seen a man risen from the dead, then if I'm going to listen to anyone tell me about God, it's going to be that guy. Right? If anyone has God's stamp of approval, it's the guy who is resurrected. Unless we think God's just going to raise some total insane heretic from the dead so that the insane heretic has his stamp of approval on him. No, that sounds very weird. If God is doing a supernatural resurrection, and having him appear to all these people, it seems like God is giving his stamp of approval to this person and his teachings. And so we look at Jesus and his teachings, and we find that he is the divine Son who would die on the cross and rise from the dead. And therefore, I'm sitting there as an atheist, whether I like this or not, this has God's stamp of approval. And so I need to believe this instead of something else. Now, that message, though, the resurrection, in addition to other things, there are all kinds of things that are involved in the resurrection, but part of the message of the resurrection is that God can take the worst thing imaginable and turn it into the best thing imaginable. If you look, I can't imagine something worse than what happened at the cross, right? I mean, no. Poor defenseless child getting a broken leg and his muscles don't work and stuff. That is bad. You know, when I had to watch it, because they had to reset his leg and then it didn't work right, so they had to reset it again, and then that didn't work, and so then they had to operate and so on. And you know, seeing a kid who hasn't done anything wrong and you know he has to go through all of this, that's bad. Hurricane's bad, but the creator of all the universe, in whom we live and move and have our being, the one who sustains us in every breath we take, entering creation and then being flogged and killed at the hands of sinful men, that is really the worst possible thing. And so Jesus dies at the hands of sinful human beings, the worst possible thing that could happen, and yet it turns out to be the greatest thing that has ever happened. And that's proven by Jesus' resurrection. And so that's why we can look at the awful things that happen in the world and saying, look, I see what you're going through, but I believe some amazing things are on the horizon if you're being attacked like that. Or Nabil, with all the things he's done and all the potential he had to do more things in the future, if he does die, can still believe that amazing things could happen as a result of that. And that, by the way, that applies to the entire world. You look around at the world and sort of worst things we have to deal with as far as, you know, what we have to deal with as Christians, people make fun of us, right? There are people who make fun of us and treat us like we're stupid for being Christians. People who treat us like we're getting in their way or we're obstacles to them, that's kind of what we have to deal with as Christians in the West. Very different in other parts of the world, where you can be, you know, beaten and tortured and killed, and you're viewed as a second-class human being, and people can just rape you and do whatever they want to you, and most people in the society don't care because you're viewed as lower than the rest of them. And I've read such tragic stories coming out of places like Pakistan, where Christians are second-class citizens. They refer to them as sweepers because Christians are good for nothing but, you know, being street sweepers or something like that. So they refer to Christians as the nickname of Christians is sweepers. And I've read stories there where, you know, young Christian girl will be raped by local Muslim men or youths, and the parents will want the men prosecuted, and it's actually the Christian community who comes to the girl's family and says, don't report this, don't prosecute this, because if you do, we're all in trouble. And I mean, the level of oppression you have to be under to say, little girl, if you got raped, you just have to live with it, don't complain about it, or the same thing's going to happen to all of us, let's just sweep this under the rug because we're sweepers and hope that this goes away. That sort of life and the psychological trauma you must have undergone throughout your entire life is really, really sad. But that's how Christians have to live in certain parts of the world. And of course we look to terrorism everywhere. Across the Muslim world now, everyone has their own terrorist group, and amazingly, they come to very similar conclusions about how they are to deal with unbelievers. Boko Haram, culturally, it would be completely different. That's Nigeria, right? Different languages, different ethnicities, completely different from someplace like Pakistan or Afghanistan. And yet, when the terrorist group comes into being and forms, Boko Haram has remarkably similar views on how to deal with unbelievers as the Taliban, even though they're a good ways away in the world. Why do they come to similar conclusions? Well, they're reading the same sources. They're reading the same sources on how you deal with unbelievers. And so you have this situation where we know where they're getting their ideas, and yet in our country, if you speak out on behalf of oppressed Christian minorities, oppressed anyone, oppressed Hindus, oppressed Yazidis, if you speak out on their behalf and draw attention to what the Muslim sources say about this kind of thing, you are now labeled a hate group. The Southern Poverty Law Center will label you a hate group for saying that this has anything to do with Islam. And so that's an awful situation that we're in. The Christians in Pakistan can't speak out on their own behalf or they will be attacked by mob. And we can't speak out on their behalf, or we're labeled hate groups. Now, of course, guess what? Of those two groups, who still has an easier time if someone wants to speak out? That would be us, right? We still have it easier, right? And that's something that's amazing to me, right? If someone labels me a hate group for speaking out on behalf of oppressed peoples, I would have to wear that hate group label like a badge, because the people doing the labeling are the ones who have a serious problem there if they're labeling as hate groups people who are defending the oppressed. We're the ones, right? There are people in this world right now who cannot speak out on their own behalf, or they will be obliterated. And so the only people who can speak out on their behalf is us. And so I think we need to take that very seriously. But as far as what's going on in the world, as depressing as it is, where you have Boko Haram in Nigeria and Al-Shabaab in Somalia and ISIS in Iraq and elsewhere, the Taliban in Pakistan and Afghanistan, and Christians who live in most of these areas and other religious minorities living in most of these areas, and if you can actually look at the chart, the number of terrorist attacks. The number of terrorist attacks over the last 15 to 20 years, when it's graphed by year, goes something like this. It's increasing rapidly. It's increasing geometrically as these groups form. So we look at that sort of thing, and if, guess what, you know, that's the sort of thing you want to see in your bank account or something like that, right? You want to see that kind of graph. You don't want to see that with people who are being killed in the name of Allah. Because if you look at that and it's going like that, unless it drops off quickly for some reason, that does not look good. Because if you're thinking, well, if it keeps going like that, then 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road, much worse. So there are some very depressing things going on in the world. And yet, I don't want to leave you on, you know, on these sad notes. We have much to be encouraged about. And again, this goes back to, we could call it resurrection thinking, right? When something looks the worst, maybe the best is right there and you're not seeing it. So persecution in the world, there's more persecution right now than there has been in history. And at the same time, more people are coming to Christ now than at any other time in history. Just this morning I was looking at a Pew study on Christianity in sub-Saharan Africa. So the north is controlled by Islam. Sub-Saharan Africa is the rest of Africa. And in the year 1900, less than 10% of sub-Saharan Africa was Christian. So less than 10%, they're a minority. Today, 60% of sub-Saharan Africa are Christian. Now that is amazing. A little over a century seems like a long time to us. That's a drop in the bucket for such a change over such a short span of time, going from under 10% to around 60% to forming a majority. There are some people there doing some amazing work. There are local preachers doing work, there are missionaries doing work, but that is an amazing example of how the gospel is impacting lives. On a different area, in a different area of the world, we have China. Much to be encouraged about in China, because you know that's an area where historically the gospel would be frowned upon. That is a communist country. Communist countries view religion as a threat to communism, because communism is founded on the idea that the people need to rise up, overthrow the economic leaders, and so on, and be led by the people. And they view religion, but Christianity especially, as something that lulls people into complacency so that they don't rise up and overthrow the economic powers and so on. And so Christianity is always a threat to the spread of communism. And that's why if you've heard about how Christians are treated in communist countries, very bad. They do not like you being a Christian there. And yet, Christianity is exploding in China. And within if current growth rates stay consistent, then Christianity in a few decades is going to be a majority population in China. And studies show that depending on the area, between 50 and 90% of people of Chinese who convert to Christianity do so on the basis of witnessing a miraculous healing, either from themselves, someone they had some problem and someone showed up and laid hands on them and they were healed, or someone they knew was miraculously healed. And that is a lot of people to be claiming to have witnessed miraculous healings. But we see this kind of growth in China. So you have massive, rapid growth in Africa and massive, rapid growth in China, growth of Christianity. And in between all of that is the Muslim world. And of course, that's the most difficult area, right? I mean, it's Islam and communist countries are sort of the most difficult areas. And yet, Christianity is growing rapidly in communist countries, and Christianity is growing rapidly in Muslim-controlled areas as well. Many underground churches have formed, and the growth rates are astounding, even in the Muslim world. Now, it's still difficult to think about the persecution, because they catch these Christians who are leading underground churches, and they charge them with the crime of spreading corruption in the land, and they can be they can be, of course, put in jail or prison. And if you've converted, that is still a death penalty in several Muslim countries. So it's easy to look at that and get depressed. But we are actually, and this is the resurrection thinking going on here. As bad as things get, and even though persecution is at all-time highs, we, the people in this room, the Christians of this generation, have never in all of history had anything close to the kinds of opportunities we have right now to reach Muslims or any other groups. We've never had these opportunities. You think, what are you talking about? You had all these great preachers in the old days. Yeah, you had great preachers. You know, when Jesus preached, he was preaching on the side of a hill, right? You could only speak to the number of people there, or sometimes they would have a relay system where he would say it and then another person would yell it, things like that. They had that in the ancient world. But basically, you're speaking to however many people you can yell to. And more recently, of course, you have technology. Eventually, you have radio. Before that, you could put things in books and spread them around. But as far as spreading information right now, I can take my smartphone, record myself saying something, and it doesn't matter what it is. 10,000 people will watch it around the world. And that is, I mean, if you think about that, right? Right now, speaking to those of you in this room, technology allows us to say whatever we want to people around the world. Now, that can be a bad thing because that means you can spread heretical nonsense if you want around the world. But as far as people who want to reach people with the gospel, we've never had these kinds of opportunities. Nothing close to what, I mean, they couldn't even have dreamed of this just 15 or 20 years ago. We couldn't have dreamed of the opportunities that we've had right now. And so two really amazing things have happened just within our lifetimes that give us the opportunities that no other generation. In fact, I would say three things have happened within our lifetimes that make it so that no other generation of Christians has ever had anything close to our opportunities. The first would be Muslims coming to the West. And this can be temporary, going to school, or it can be, you know, actually immigrating to the United States. But historically, civilizations have been fairly segregated. You had, you know, the Muslim East and the Christian West, and here's where the Hindus are, and so on. And so if you wanted to reach Muslims with the gospel a couple centuries ago, if you really had a heart for Muslims, you had to go to a Muslim area, and if you happened to be successful in preaching, you had a very good chance of your head being separated from the rest of your body. That's what you had to do back then if you really wanted to reach Muslims. Why? You would go your entire life without seeing a Muslim unless you actually did some traveling and went there, in which case that was a very dangerous area to be in. More recently, guess what? If you walk out of this church and walk down the street, you're going to run into some Muslims. And so if you want to reach Muslims, and Christians have been commanded to go out into all nations, making disciples, baptizing them in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. If you want to obey that, life just got much easier because now all the nations are coming to you. Now all the nations are coming right outside your church. So they're coming to you. How much easier could it possibly be now to make disciples of all nations? Guess what? If someone comes here and is going to college here from Saudi Arabia, you can make a disciple of the nation of Saudi Arabia. It's going to be in Saudi Arabia. You can do that without leaving home. If you want to, and even if you're not talking about Muslims who have come here, so that's one thing. Muslims have come to the West. The second thing is, again, the technological consideration that right now you can pick up your phone and talk to Muslims in Saudi Arabia on Facebook. No one has had that, right? We just take it for granted. Oh, okay, I could do that if I wanted to, but we take it for granted. Christian missionaries and evangelists from centuries past would have given anything to have anything even close to that kind of opportunity to reach people. And we have it, and, you know, we play Candy Crush, right? I've never played Candy Crush, I just hear about it. So that's the technology. I mean, that is an amazing thing that now you can post something, and people in Pakistan and Afghanistan and Saudi Arabia and so on can see it. And the reason that's important is for centuries, Muslim leaders were able to keep their people insulated from that sort of thing, right? You only hear what your leaders tell you, and they're telling you all sorts of things about Islam, and they're not letting any alternatives to Islam get to you. So you are completely insulated from hearing any criticisms of Islam or hearing any alternatives to Islam. That has changed within our lifetimes, right? We had 14 centuries of Muslim leaders insulating their people, keeping them isolated from everything else, to all of a sudden we are able to reach any Muslim with an internet connection. And that's a lot of Muslims. And so it's like a wall has just been lifted, a barrier, a force field has just been lifted, and we have every opportunity we could possibly want. So those are two of the things. The third thing would be, suddenly, for the first time in 14 centuries, Christians have open access to Islam's most trusted sources. Back in the day, they had some odd translations of the Quran, but Muslims believe in lots more than just the Quran. Even Islam's most basic practices don't come from the Quran, they come from the Hadith. These are collections of the teachings and example of Muhammad. And the two main collections, Sahih al-Bukhari and Sahih Muslim, weren't translated until the 1990s. So people didn't have them. If you wanted them, you had to go to the Middle East and get them in Arabic, and if you didn't speak Arabic, you were going to have all kinds of problems. So that's just in the 1990s. The other major Muslim sources have been translated since then. So just within our lifetimes, we have all of the sources that can be used to refute all of the lies that they've been told. And I say lies because I don't just mean, hey, their leaders are telling them false things that they happen to believe. Their leaders tell them false things that they know are false. And I'm not talking about some conspiracy theory. Anyone who's read the Muslim sources knows that the Quran has not been perfectly preserved. Entire chapters came up missing, large passages came up missing. Aisha had verses, and she had the only copy, and a sheep came in and ate them. There were all kinds of people who had passages of the Quran memorized, went into battle and died, and no one else knew those passages. In fact, according to Muslim sources, the entire reason for compiling the Quran into a book, it wasn't meant to be a book. People were meant to have parts memorized. It was only compiled into a book because so much of it was lost, and Abu Bakr, the caliph, said, before we lose any more, we need to put everything that's left into a book, and that way if more of us die, we'll still have whatever's left. The entire reason that the Quran is a book right now is because so much of it was lost. And yet every Muslim leader tells his followers, the Quran has been perfectly preserved right down to the letter from the time it was revealed to Muhammad. They say that because then they can say the Bible's been corrupted, but the Quran has been perfectly preserved. So the Quran is obviously the word of God. It's been divinely protected. And for 14 centuries, they could say things like that to their followers. No one is going to correct them. If you start questioning your leaders, you're in trouble. They'll start calling you an apostate or a hypocrite. And so we're the first generation that actually has the sources out before us to go and say, hey, you're actually... You've been misled. And with Muslims, they've been told so many things that are factually false that they've spread themselves out so thin that Islam is actually much, much weaker than many people think. It reminds me, I'll have to wrap up with this, but it reminds me of, if you remember Alexander the Great, during the time of Alexander the Great, the Greeks had, in the centuries prior to that, the Greeks had awful problems with the Persians. The Persians keep invading with their empire, and the Greeks would fight them off and so on. But at the time of Alexander, the Greeks still regarded the Persian Empire as a super powerful empire. And travelers had started coming back during the time of Philip of Macedon, that's Alexander's father, and telling them, you know those Persians that we think are really powerful? Their forts are just crumbling. Their soldiers are all lying around drunk. Any well-disciplined force could go in there and take over the entire empire. And Alexander said, okay. And Alexander conquered the entire Persian Empire almost instantly and then went on conquering and so on. But that's sort of how I feel with Islam. People think it's this huge thing, so many Muslims, 1.6 billion Muslims. It must be so powerful. And yet, anytime you ask a Muslim, why do you believe in Islam? You hear factually false information, factually false information, factually false information. I don't mean things that I happen to disagree with. I mean I can open your book and show you that what you've been told is not true according to your own sources. And so all that's really needed is a well-equipped group of Christians to learn to refute the claims that Muslims have, to learn to defend Christianity and the gospel and basic Christian doctrine from the objections that we know they've used, and that their same leaders who tell them things like the Quran has been perfectly preserved and so on, tell them, here are the arguments you can use against Christians that Christians can never refute. If Christians learn responses to those things, learn how to defend our basic doctrines, and learn how to expose the claims that have been told to Muslims that are just factually false, if we do those things, a small group of well-equipped Christian witnesses, I believe that we're going to see more Muslims come to Christ than all generations before us combined. And again, that would be some resurrection thinking.